Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Devin McCoy, and this is the Dirt Bike Journals. Welcome back, everyone. For those of you that are new, the Dirt Bike Journals is a podcast for dirt bikers by dirt bikers. And here we share stories about our dirt bikes. So if you have a story or anything about dirt bikes you'd like to share with me, please reach out through Instagram or Facebook. You can also send an email to thedirtbikejournals@gmail.com. Now, let's listen to today's guest.
Sam, thank you for coming to the Dirt Bike Journal. Well, me coming to you. I've been wanting to talk to you for a little while, so thanks for making time.
Well, thanks for coming to Heber.
Yeah, it wasn't too far, I guess. So, and I like the drive anyway, other than some of those parts in Provo Canyon sketch me out just a little bit. When I see the temperature drop from 48 outside and it's down to like 32, and then the water's all over the road. I'm like, oh, great. I'm going to be into the barrier in no time.
There's some good ones in Provo Canyon here and there.
Yeah. So, I wanted to talk to you about a couple of things. Normally, when we get started out, I want you to tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell me where you grew up, where you're from.
So I grew up in Wyoming, a little town called Cokeville. Grew up on a ranch there, and I grew up without dirt bikes. I mean, my dad was kind of anti-dirt bike, honestly, and we just had a couple four-wheelers. But cattle ranch, Wyoming, small town, no stoplights. That's how I started.
Well, that's pretty neat. So. How long were you in Cokeville all the way through high school?
Yeah, so
headed out.
My folks are still there. In fact, yeah. So I
same ranch.
My dad's still running cattle. He was an electrician for 42 years at a power plant in Kemmer, So he is still there. Grew up there, and I was the only boy, so I was pretty busy on the ranch, to be honest with you. Had some sisters, and I left the ranch when I was 18, 19, and kind of went out from there. I later came to school here in Utah and got a degree, and that's where I met my wife, was when I was going to school here. And so here I've stayed, actually.
Cool. And you started out where in Utah? Where were you at, down in the valley?
So, I moved to Provo, went to school at Provo, BYU for 5 years, got an engineering degree. Then we built our first home down in the valley, out by Lehigh area is where we built our first home. By the way, I regret not keeping that home.
Right. I know that remorse.
So we had that home for 5 years, and then I wanted to get kind of out of the valley, and so we came to Heber, and that's why we ended up in Heber.
Very cool. A good choice. But yeah, I mean, I look back at when I sold my townhome to try to build our first home, and you know, when they say when there's a will, there's a way, I could have found a way to keep the home and turn it into a rental of some sort.
Right.
And yeah, I'm kicking myself for not doing that now, because rent's just so high right now.
Glad I'm not the only one kicking myself for that mistake.
Yeah, so now I'm looking around at all these little homes around town. I'm like, oh, maybe I can pick that one up, but I don't know.
Right.
That's kind of it was a once-in-a-lifetime situation there. So
it was down in the valley when I lived down there that I actually met a guy in my neighborhood that we were just kind of talking before we got on here. His name's Gary Goodwin. Shout out to Gary, but Gary was in my neighborhood, and that's how I got into dirt bike riding. And it was actually kind of, I didn't mean to really even get into dirt bike riding. I was a street bike guy. So I spent a couple of years out in California, and when I was out there, I kind of saw all these street bikes, these bullet bikes that would go cutting through lanes of traffic. And being a Wyoming boy, this was a revelation to me. I was like, this is... And I remember seeing these bikes. So when I got home from California, I kind of started looking into street bikes and got street bikes. I never ridden a motorcycle. So the way I learned to ride a street bike is I went and test drove people's bikes that were selling them. And
nice. Game in the system.
That's how I got in. Bought my first bike for like, I think it was $1,100, I think. An old street bike, you know, and fixed it up a little bit. And So I was into street bikes, and I had street bikes, a lot of them, after I got into them and enjoyed that kind of thing. I actually had a company for a while, for about 10 years, where I did exhaust for bullet bikes. And so I love the street bike thing, but I happened to trade. I bought a truck. I was at an auction, and I see this box truck. And I was like, it was going really cheap. I was like, I should buy that. I can make money. I mean, I hadn't looked at it. I had no idea. So I bought this box truck for like $2,500. Well, I got it and had a blown engine.
Oh, perfect.
It ran, but it had a blown head gasket. Oh, and so it wasn't very, there's a reason it was there.
Right.
So I traded this box truck for a Chinese four-wheeler because I thought, well, that's better than a bad box truck. And then after I had the Chinese four-wheeler, someone traded me the Chinese four-wheeler for a Kawasaki 250, a KLR 250. I think they call it a Sherpa. Just a little 250, yeah. Four-stroke, enduro kind of bike, you know, a dual sport. And I had that, and that's when Gary, he knew I had that. And he's like, hey, me and another guy are going for a ride, adventure ride. Do you want to come with us? I was like, oh, yeah, sure, why not? So I took a sleeping bag and put it in a garbage sack and went with him with a street helmet. And that was my first taste of dirt ever.
Oh, yeah?
So we
did
went.
Did you even have knobbies on it or anything?
It had like, I mean, kind of the dual tire, you know, so it wasn't very knobby, but it was
right.
It was at least made for gravel roads. And we went for, I think I only went one night and I had to come back because I had something going on the weekend. So I went for one night and I thought it was the greatest thing ever to go, you know, camping mm-hmm. and riding bikes. Wasn't very good at it, but it was, you know, it was a ton of fun. So then I started looking into, well, maybe in fact, the reason I mean, Gary was on a 990 adventure. I'm on a 250. I remember him and this other guy left me at the bottom of this hill outside of Camas. I mean, they went up this hill and the 250 mm-hmm. would barely go up it, you yeah. know, like 40 miles an hour. And yeah. they just cruised at 80. And I was like, well, maybe I need a bigger bike if I'm going to do this.
Probably. So did Gary get you into any kind of a bike or like give you advice on something?
Well, so Gary had a 990 adventure and I was, I couldn't ride a 990. So I went and got a 650, an old Kawasaki 650. It was an old one. And
like an old KLR?
An old KLR is what it was. Okay. It was an old, it was the first version, or the first generation, I should say, KLR. And went and rode that a little bit. And Gary kept inviting me. And to his credit, I mean, I think he's probably got a lot of people in the sport, but he would invite me, and I was a terrible rider. Knew nothing and was slow. And, I mean, I had my stuff in a garbage sack. I mean, I was an embarrassment, but he... He had me come, and I'd go again, and bit by bit, I got, you know, the bigger bike and was able to just go out on more of these adventure rides with him and really just enjoyed going out. You know, it was just a lot of fun. And then as things kind of progressed, the really first legitimate bike I had was Gary invited me to go to Mexico with him for 10 days. And a group. And so I went and bought a used KTM 525. Cool. And that was my first dirt bike ever.
Yeah.
And I cut my teeth in Mexico, you know, on, you know, my first real probably dirt biking. So.
Yeah. Man, what an experience that must have been.
Mexico?
Had you ever been to Mexico before?
No, no. If you want to know how clueless I was, Devin, when I went to Mexico with Gary, I didn't know how to put my pads on. So I
on
watched
your knees,
yeah, and elbows. I didn't know if they went on the inside or the outside. Of,
right.
I had no idea. And oh, here I'm going to go so do 1,000 miles in Mexico, and I don't even know how to get dressed. So I watched the guys ahead of me. I kind of was slow and I was seeing what they were doing.
Kind of looking around.
Yeah, I didn't want to look like a too big of a rookie.
Uh huh.
Do you want to ask?
Oh man, that would have been so such a riot though. I've been invited to go down to Baja next year, and it kind of terrifies me a little bit.
Go.
I speak Spanish, but
oh, you should
still,
go. Yeah, I mean, no,
you're down there with your bike and your wits, basically.
So know? I've been twice now to Baja. I'm going to be there in 2 weeks. I'm going to be there again.
Cool.
With Gary. actually.
Oh, really?
So
it's funny. I got a guy from work that's going down too. So it's the season of Baja, I guess.
It's so fun. You need to go.
I do.
And the people are so nice.
That's what I hear. The whole circuit down there, just love to see all these people coming down there doing the Baja stuff because they're coming down there to have a good time. They're not, you know, the typical tourist.
Right.
So yeah. they're definitely a little more down to earth.
Food's great. The the people are great. I mean, people always say to me that probably don't know a lot about Baja as well, are you afraid of being hurt or afraid? And it's probably akin to me. Like, I mean, you can go to places in Chicago or Detroit that you shouldn't be, that if you go, you're going to, you're going to get yourself in trouble. And it's probably the same with Mexico. You just, you know, if you're down there for the wrong reasons, going to the wrong places, you can probably find trouble.
Yeah.
But you can in any big U.S. city too, I think.
Right, right. Those dangers are everywhere. So you started off with kind of unconventional motorcycles, I guess.
For sure.
And then, so now I hate to say it like this because you'll shoot it down, but you're kind of a big deal around here as far as like a technical hard enduro rider.
Shoot that down.
I know you are. But you know your stuff. You're good at it. You know, sure, you've had your ups and downs, your bruises and your breaks, but some of the stuff, like the Pritchett Gap, we call it, like you're the first person I saw do that. And we were all like, you know, minds blown, like, holy crap, he just gapped that thing right there. And so when was it that you picked up a bike that was capable of those kinds of things, and what drew you into that?
Okay, yeah, so there's this whole dichotomy between street and off-road, and you don't know it if you're only a street rider because you think that you're, and we kind of joke about this now, but if you're a street guy only, sometimes you think you're pretty bad, right? And then when you go to dirt, you realize that that's where the real skill is riding dirt. And so when I started riding dirt, I realized my whole kind of opened up to me about this whole world of riding, that there's a lot more to know. And going back to getting kind of going, I told this story before, but I remember going back to my friend Gary again. He bought a 950 Super Enduro, and this is a V-twin dirt bike that they didn't make a bunch of them. KTM made this. It's called a Super Enduro, different from their Adventure, but it's a dual sport bike, but it's basically a big V-twin dirt bike.
Wow.
Gary bought this thing, and he took it to Death Valley, and I was on a KLR. And I remember we got out into snow, a lot of snow, and it was cold and stuff. But we were out in this field, and it was muddy and snowy, and we couldn't go anywhere. And Gary was on this V-twin dirt bike throwing 35-foot roosts, and I was just like, I was blown away. This was a cool bike. I mean, yeah. It had the twin exhaust, and it's throwing a 35-foot roost. And I was like, all right, this thing was – so on the way home from Death Valley, I – was looking, found my 950 Super Enduro that I later bought from this guy in Arizona, had that bike for 10 years. First real, I mean, but the reason I tell this story is there was this ride that when I was learning with my 950 Enduro, Super Enduro, and that's not the bike to learn on, by the way, but
probably not.
Gary and I were doing this ride once, and he went up this hill really, and I could not get up it. I could not get up the hill, and he could go right up it. And I asked him, I was like, how did you get up that hill? And he's like, well, you got to feather the clutch. And growing up on a ranch, I mean, you don't feather clutches. You never ride the clutch. That is the cardinal rule. You get your foot off the clutch when you feed the cows. I mean,
yep.
That's what Dad teaches. You don't ride the clutch. And so he explained this concept of using a clutch that was just like, as kind of a mechanical person that I am, I was like, I didn't think you did that. I didn't think you'd ever want to feather a clutch. And that's kind of when my whole world was like, wow, there's this, yeah. So that was a long answer to that question. But that's when I first started to realize, a little bit more about this world and dirt and all these things that make dirt riding what it is. The first bike that I ever got was a Beta 300, a 2015 race edition base. It was a two-stroke, my first really good dirt bike. I had the KTM 525. I even had a KTM 250 SXF, which wasn't very good when I bought it. I didn't have it very long for trail riding because it didn't work, obviously, but I didn't know that at the time. So the 300 was the first bike I got, and that was the first bike I really started, you know, just trying to learn some stuff on. In fact, I had a pipe out here in my backyard. It's 20 inches of culvert, concrete one.
Yeah.
I remember just trying to think of how can I get over this? I knew people did it. I've seen videos of, you know, people popping over stuff like that, but I couldn't get over it. How do you get over? So 300, I'd go back and forth and roll up to it and trying to hit it and case it and fall over and try again. And so for me, that's where it all started.
That's cool. I remember riding, I was so stupid. After I had the DR350, I was young and dumb, still kind of young and dumb. But I thought, I just need more power. So I went out and got a WR426, worst bike I could have ever owned in my life.
Heavy.
Heavy, and it didn't run very well to begin with. Mm. It had problems overheating, and the hot start wouldn't work. Even you know, it didn't matter how many times you pulled that lever. Like, you couldn't get the thing to start again after you dumped it when it was hot. So you just have to sit there and wait. But I remember there was this log, and it was, I don't know, it wasn't even up to my knee. And it had, like, junk in front of it, too. And I remember hitting that thing, and I'd get high-centered on it, and I'd roll back, like, no, I'm going to do this clean. I probably hit it 10 or 15 times before I just finally, you know, burned my tire out on it until it caught and rolled up over it. And, yeah, I kind of forgot about trying to be an enduro rider for a while until I got rid of that bike and realized that there's actually bikes that are capable of helping you do that. So, yeah, I can imagine looking at that concrete pipe and thinking, this is, how do they do this? And did you have, like, access to YouTube to just sit there and watch hours of people jumping it?
I'm trying to think, you know, I mean, probably, you know, I don't think YouTube was quite back in 2015 like it is now. Maybe it, I don't think there was the content on there that it is now, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, yeah, there's definitely, I remember just, you know, I knew I could do it, but as I tried to do it, it just was so hard to get over this stupid pipe. But I worked on it and tried and, you know, when I finally got over that, it was like this, wow, okay, I can, you know, I can learn, I can do this. Mm-hmm. And it's so satisfying to have that accomplishment. And that's, to me, kind of what dirt bike riding has been all about, is just this, it's not about being the best for me, because I'll never be, you know, that's not going to happen. But just being able to get better and look back and, you know, do stuff that you couldn't do before is so satisfying. For me, it's so self-satisfying. That's what I love about the sport.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I totally get where you're coming from with that. It's to look back at the things I couldn't do 3 years ago, and now those trails I just whiz by.
Right.
Like, I'm just, you know, out for a joyride. So they're very satisfying. So tell me about, this is something that the weekend warriors generally deal with, is balancing riding dirt bikes with your job and with your family. What have you figured out?
Well, I don't have no answers for that. ask my wife. There's only so many hours in a day, and I'm a business owner. You're a business owner. There's responsibilities on, you know, then we have kids. In fact, we both have four kids. I mean, you and I both are playing the same game of how do you do with the things you love. So for me, I'll tell you what I have learned, and one thing that's been really good for my marriage and with dirt biking is my wife has always seen that I love to do this and go on these trips, and that's kind of hard. But now that our kids are a little bit older, and I still have four kids in the home, but she's able to, they're all at school fortunately now, but she got into tennis, and now she has this hobby that she loves. Mm-hmm. And so I do everything I can to try to help her go on tournaments and trips and enjoy her hobby, because you know, it's kind of this, we both help each other enjoy their hobby, and that makes things so much, you know, easier now, because you know, it's not so that's helped. But I would ride way more often if I didn't have a family. I mean, the reality is, so there's definitely things that are a balance. I try to ride when I can, sometimes during the week, and try to have weekends open for my family. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's not always possible, because a lot of times weekend trips come. So,
yeah,
I don't know that I have the answer, but it's, I definitely, there's things I used to do that I don't anymore. Like, you know, I grew up hunting in Wyoming. Mm-hmm. I haven't gone hunting forever now because I like to dirt bike. Now that's what I'm going to do with my spare time. You know what I mean? Yeah. So.
Yeah. It's funny how your hobbies change.
They do. Well, mine have.
Well, mine have changed all the time. My wife says I'm transient when it comes to my hobbies, but I don't think dirt biking is going away. But back in, it was probably 2005, 2006, my dad and I got big into rappelling and canyoneering. So we were canyoneering down in southern Utah every other weekend, and we go do that forever. And then when I got married, you know, we got a little bit busy. My wife would still come with us sometimes, but that kind of died out, and we got back into riding side-by-sides and four-wheelers and stuff. And then I picked up a dirt bike, and we were all just doing the power sport thing. And that's kind of, it's kind of come and gone. We did four-wheelers forever, and then we did basically hiking and canyoneering for a long time. Mm-hmm. Then I'm into dirt bikes, and my dad does side-by-sides now. And yeah, it just changes over time a little bit. That's just the sacrifices and change we have in our lives. There's really no rhyme or reason.
So you mentioned to me that you got some bikes for your kids, and so mm-hmm. I've done the same. But my question would be for you is, I have one boy that's, you know, I can tell he's going to be into it. I have another boy that's just on the fence about it, and mm-hmm. he'll kind of go, but I don't push it with him. I don't try to push it too much with my kids. What do you do with your kids?
Well, it's kind of hard to say because they're still at the age where they think I'm super cool. So that hasn't changed yet. So whatever I do, they want to do. So mm-hmm. if I'm riding a motorcycle, they're wanting to get on their little e-bikes and rip around.
Oh, that's
they
cool.
want to ride on the bars with me. So I got this little 60, and my middle boy, he's really excited. He wants to go ride dirt bikes all the time, and he's an animal. I can tell he's just going to take to it. Mm-hmm. He's out there doing bank turns where he's grinding pegs
wow.
out in the parking lot.
Like, how old is he?
He's he'll be 6 this year.
Oh, wow.
6 tomorrow, actually, or on Wednesday. But, yeah, he's really into it. The other one, he kind of goes back and forth between, like yours. He's like, oh, maybe, kind of on the fence about it. Talks about wanting a four-wheeler because there's more power, but I think it's easier because it's four wheels. And I can't, I grew up with four wheelers and I know what they'll do to you. I'm not really pushing them. If they want to get into it, I'm going to try my best to provide them something to ride. My wife loves to get out and ride too. So that's
really,
So it's kind of helpful. She's had a motorcycle, but we had 2 kids in diapers when we got the bike, so there's very little time to use it. Yeah. So we'll see what she gets into. But yeah, I'm just going to have to hope for the best.
What does she ride?
Right now, she just rides my King Quad 700, a four-wheeler.
Okay,
yeah, I see. Or we borrow her brother's that has power steering.
So has she tried a dirt bike?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, she was on, Gary had a GPX 250 four-stroke and air-cooled bike. Mm-hmm. And she rode that. It was e-start. It was really easy to ride. A super low seat. I think it was like a 31-32 inch seat height, so she could ride that really easy, and she loved it. She got out and rode, and we did some fun trails, but we just got too busy with babies. So her hands were full all the time. She couldn't set a kid down and go riding,
right?
Because I'd need to go with her. So we kind of put it on hold for a little while, but our youngest is going to be 2 in June, so we'll start getting things going a little bit more. So
to be continued.
To be continued. No more kids, but well, to be continued with our riding stories for sure. But yeah, the family thing, I hope it takes off because I was an only child. So growing up, it was my mom and my dad and me, and we were always out on a four-wheeler. We started out, all 3 of us, on the back of a 4-Trax 350 riding Reeder Canyon down in Joe's Valley and stuff.
Right.
And I'm just bobbling along, you know, up on, you know, 8 inches of cushion so I could see anything, holding on to my mom, holding on to my dad. And then we just kind of graduated having more stuff. So I hope my kids will follow that. Mm. If I can provide it, I think they'll do it. We'll see.
Well, amen to that. I feel the same.
Yeah.
It's fun going with your kids. It really is.
Yeah.
I enjoy it.
So tell me about your progression with your online stuff. What made you decide to want to put out because yours is the SOB channel, right?
Right.
So tell me about how all that got started and your Instagram stuff, your Facebook stuff. What, I mean, obviously it's just kind of the natural progression of things. Everybody's putting everything online. But, you know, what did you want to accomplish with it?
Yeah, mine was probably a little different, and my views probably show that. I did videos because I liked to document my trips for me. And I did like to share them too, but I mean, the reason I was videoing and a lot of that is because it's so fun when you're late at night dreaming about dirt bikes to go revisit some of these adventures you've had, and I look at some of those obstacles and I remember when that was, how scared I was and conquering that, and it's just this reliving it. So that's kind of why I video them, and like I say, and to share, wasn't just so. And the first videos I did were horrible, and so it kind of was fun to learn about editing and get some better equipment, and then drones, and then you know, just kind of play with the craft of videoing and some of that. And recently I've done some reviews and some voiceovers, and those by far have gotten the most views.
Yeah.
But for me, they're the easiest videos to make. I mean, the editing of the other videos that have a lot less views of the technical writing and stuff have way more work in them, but people are interested in reviews, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. But for me, I liked watching videos online of people that motivated me to go ride and to ride harder, you know what I mean? I wasn't so much interested in reviews as I was just how some videos would motivate me. I'd see them, that would really get me excited.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I wanted to create my content. And so I've done some of that. So I've never really been chasing particularly views, but just to make videos that inspire myself or others to kind of just want to go ride. You know what I mean? I don't do much on Instagram. I'll post a few things, but so that's kind of it in a nutshell. SOB channel, by the way, is my initials. SOB or my initials.
That's cool.
So I think a lot of people are like, where'd that come from?
Right.
It's just my initials.
That's cool. That's cool to hear that explanation, because I had a different one in my head.
I think most people probably do.
Yeah, that's cool.
It's probably not a good name for, I mean, if you're going for views and stuff.
That's great. Everybody wants to click on the SOB channel. I remember watching two of your videos. I mentioned it earlier. One was that Pritchett Gap, that two rock setup with the 4-foot gap or 6-foot gap in the middle. And I actually haven't personally gone up there to see that thing yet, but my buddy Nate went up there. I think he rode with you.
Nate Johnson?
Nate Johnson.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Last time I was in...
Yeah, he went and rode it.
We met him just in Pritchett by...
By happenstance.
By happenstance. And yeah, he came with us and he rode it. Yeah,
he's a good rider.
That was fun to watch him, see him hit that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'll bet he was pretty nervous. But I remember watching another video of you, and it looked like it was Tocqueville Twister. I can't even remember the video now, but it was one you'd posted of some of your wrecks where you like dug the nose in and you just went over the bars and down off into the ravine a little bit. And I was like, okay, if he can crash and get up and keep riding, I can do the same thing. Like, he's not invincible. So it gave me a little bit of motivation, whether you intended it or not. But I was like, okay, even the guys that are really good have times when they crash.
I crash a lot.
Yeah, and that's the worst part for me, is when I crash, either my pride gets in the way, and I'm like, oh, I'm all mad because, you know, all my friends just saw me wreck, and I'm not as good as I'd hoped I was. But the fact is, it's just how it goes some days. So
it's interesting, you know, that in this progression is there's days you go out and ride that things just don't, you just don't ride well, and it's frustrating. It's kind of you know, you're done at the end of the day and you almost feel a little bit defeated. Or I've had those days where I feel defeated because you're like, I just did not ride well and things did not work out. And it's kind of, take it personal, or at least it's kind of me. You know, I mean, I've had those days. And then there's other days where your confidence is there and, you know those days. And it's, you get done and you're just like, there's nothing better, right?
It's such a good feeling.
Such a good feeling. So, I mean, I think that's with probably most sports. People have their highs and lows, but... it is certainly true, or has been true in my case of writing. There's days that sometimes it just doesn't come together.
Yeah. Speaking of which, you alluded earlier before we were recording about some stuff that happened in Poison Spring Canyon. You got anything you want to share about that?
Oh, well, I mean, you mentioned, hey, do you got any stories to share? And I have so many stories from dirt biking and adventure riding and all of this that there's just... I mean, it could go on for hours, but I've had so many crazy stories. And I'll tell you a few of them just to, I'll try to keep them short, but that's what's so neat about this sport is it's, you know, you get to live this whole other lifetime almost, you know, in your dirt biking career. At least that's how I see it, because I've had so many things happen. In that case, we were talking about Dirty Devil. We had crossed the Dirty Devil. We were on adventure bikes, though, in this story. So we're going out to ride and have all our gear on because we camp on the bikes, right? That's what I like about adventure riding is we don't, you know, we don't go to towns. We bring our food mm-hmm. and everything and camp wherever we end.
Yeah.
And we'd crossed and we were going up this road and we see this guy walking down the road. And, you know, that's pretty rugged country out there.
Yeah.
And he's got blood on his shirt as we get up closer and his face and he's a mess. He's got this one water bottle with him that's empty. And we're like, what are you doing? You know, what's...
Were you explaining?
Yes.
I vaguely remember hearing this story somewhere, maybe. Keep going.
Okay. Yeah, I was with Gary. Gary has been I'm going to be with him here in a couple of weeks in Mexico, like I mentioned. But Gary's, you know, got me into the sport, and we've had a million stories since then, mm-hmm. Still riding. But yeah, we come to this guy. We ask him what's going on. And when we started talking with him, he kind of went into shock a little bit. You know, he kind of started to shake, and he starts telling us about why I'm a climber. And about this morning, this is in the evening, about 5:36 in the evening, he said, this morning I tried to go across this wash that had washed out in my truck, and I didn't make it. And it slid off the wash, and it threw the door open and threw me out, and the truck's totally down in the wash. And I've been walking since this morning. And he's like, the road's pretty close. And we're like, no, the road's not close. You are a long ways from the road still.
Yeah.
And so we got him some water and kind of got him. He, you know, once he kind of talked this out, he kind of calmed down a little bit. But he mm-hmm. kind of went through this little bout of shock there. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we decided what the thing to do was in talking with him. I remember asking him, like, well, where's your phone and wallet? And he's like, well, I put it in my bag and just left it up here on the road. I got tired of carrying it. Yeah, it didn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, that happens when you're delirious.
So we decided that two of us would go up and get his stuff, his bag with his wallet and phone and stuff, and and we'd come back. So me and another guy rode up, and we found his bag about a mile from his truck, and it was just sitting on the side of the road and had a bunch of stuff in it. It really didn't make a ton of sense. I have reasons why I think that, but anyway... had a bunch of books, and he had a gun in there that he left, and his phone and his wallet. And so we got his phone and his wallet, and we rode back to him. And then we unloaded one of the bikes, the luggage from it, and put him on the back of it. And that bike and another bike went out to the road mm-hmm. and took him out to the road, crossed the river with him and took him out to the road, and then flagged down a car and sent him into Hanksville. And then... those two went down the highway. We were riding around to the bottom of Lake Powell from there, which was still another 3-hour ride, I think. I think we got in at midnight, actually. So it was probably longer than that. But we came across this truck, and it was not in a million years would you cross it with a truck.
That bad.
He'd been in there for 3 or 4 days, and he didn't want to backtrack going out because he'd gone in so deep. Okay. So he just went for it and And it threw the door open, threw him out. I was really lucky it didn't run him over because it went sliding sideways down the hill. It was so steep. Oh, it wasn't just, it was like, when we saw it, it was like, no way.
Yeah.
There's no way. Even on a dirt bike, we're just like, you know, that would. So, and he had a bunch of gas and food and everything, but, you know, he left the truck, which, you know, you hear about these stories when people leave vehicles and it happens.
Was it still upright?
Yeah, it was, but it was very stuck. I mean, because it had. It was super steep and washed out, and the door had come open and jammed into the dirt.
Oh.
And so, I mean, I was like, I don't even know how you'd get this thing out. You'd have to have a backhoe. But we later learned from him that he got a hold of his parents, and he was probably about 29, but his parents came down and got him, and then they arranged with a guy out of Hanksville to go in with a truck, and they, I think, dug it out and pulled it down the washaways and worked it out. Jeez. It took a while. But they got it out. So that's just one, you know, we find this guy. We found an older couple once out stuck in the desert too. We've had these experiences where we find people stuck. They're from Pennsylvania.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. And they thought they were close to So that's happened twice now that we've found people just roaming.
Holy cow. That's rough. What about you? What are the times that you've needed help? I thought I read somewhere that you had a plate installed somewhere or something.
Well, so I did this last year. I've been pretty accident free until 2022. But I was out snow biking, and the funny thing about this whole, or ironic thing, is I was going to be very careful that day because it was a Thursday. And we had planned a trip to go to Mexico as a family on Monday. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't going to do any big drops or anything on my snow bike. And I didn't. And I just happened to be just going across the face that was sun-baked. It was really hard. Standing on the pegs, wasn't jumping or anything. Ski somehow caught the ice, just went to the right. I literally... And all my crashes, you know, you can see it kind of happening going bad. I didn't see this going bad at all. The next thing I knew, I was on the ground, and I knew from my body's response that I was hurt.
Yeah.
But it shattered my clavicle. The surgeon who played it used the word exploded.
Oh, geez.
It wasn't just a break. It blew it up.
It's like you compressed it.
It's many, many pieces, fragments. Wow. So I got the bike up. My friend got the bike up, I should say. This is out snow biking. I rode it 16 miles back. To the truck.
Whoa.
Because if you're going to get the thing in there, you're going to be the one that gets it out. I wasn't paying for a helicopter, nor was I going to. My pride was. So I rode the bike out, went to the hospital. I knew it was bad because I could just tell from my body's response that it was like, this isn't just a bad bruise or hit.
It's funny how your body kind of indicates to you something's really wrong.
Yeah, this was different. So I knew it was bad. And then we went in got an x-ray in town, and she said, yeah, it's not just a piece. It's there's lots of pieces.
Oh, geez.
So the next day, I sent the x-ray to a orthopedic surgeon, and he said, yeah, it's definitely a surgery scenario. But it hurt a lot, as you can imagine.
Yeah. Shards.
Shards. And you gotta be careful with shards that you don't puncture your lung or something. But I knew that the most painful thing would be not going to Mexico with my wife and living for that for the next rest of my life, hearing about how I screwed up the family trip. So I just went ahead and went to Mexico with a blown up clavicle.
What?
For a week. And then when I got back, we got it plated.
Were you just the beach bum for a while?
Yeah, I just sat there.
Just in your chairs with your lemonade, hey.
But I was there.
That's good, man. Good for you. Holy cow. So how did they even plate that back together? What's that even look like?
So they take a piece of titanium, mm-hmm. And they find the ends that aren't broken, but the middle is blown out. And they put in screws on each end, get the right spacing and gap like the other side should be, and then it has to grow together. So he literally took the bones and crushed them and made a paste and just stuck it in there and said, be careful.
So how does he keep the paste all together? Does he wrap it up like a Tootsie Roll or something?
Throws it in there.
Wow. Oh, that's wild.
Yeah. Don't recommend it.
No. So that's, you got some titanium screwed to either side of your...
Yeah, so I've got a plate right there.
Yeah.
You know, and fortunately, the clavicle isn't a motion-limiting bone or anything. Yeah, it supports the muscle. But, you know, so it didn't hurt motion, range, strength kind of thing. So it grew back. And yeah, stupid, though, just... On a snow bike, not even.
Yeah.
Of all the stuff I've done, that's what so surprised me is, you know, I've had some pretty wild get offs, and that one was just.
It seems like sometimes the wildest ones we just cartwheel out of, and we're like, oh, okay, pick your bike back up and go.
So that's that. I broke a wrist last year as well.
How'd you do that one?
That was on a dirt bike. Just happened to be going through some weeds. Where I couldn't see what was in the weeds. I was transitioning from one side of a two-track to the other side of the two-track, and right in the middle was really overgrown. And as I went through that middle spot, I hit a rock that just deflected me just right, and it threw me off the bike and just broke the wrist.
Where was that at?
That was right up here behind, on the midway side of AF Fork.
So okay.
We were just leaving to go out.
Oh, geez.
But that one I didn't have to have any surgery on, fortunately. But that was worse probably than the clavicle.
Well, yeah, I mean, you do everything with your fingers and moving those tendons through that wrist.
Yeah.
Ugh. That'd be horrible. Just put on a wrist brace and go.
Yeah. I let it heal, but it's a slow healing. It was a scaphoid bone, which is only fed by one vessel. Anyway, slow healing bone. But I'm a real believer, whether it's right or wrong, that the rest will kill you faster than the abuse. And so, you know, my physical therapy is using my hands for work every day. You know what I mean? So I didn't just do nothing with it. I tried not to over abuse it, but with my shoulder and my wrist and stuff, I try to find this balance of moving it, having the blood flow through it, keeping motion and range in it, not abusing it, trying to, but definitely not using it. You know what I mean? Yeah. There's some use
to atrophy and
yeah. So that's my take on that, but probably wrong.
No, I think that sounds logical to me.
Seems to me, but
go for it. Yeah, our last trip down to Warner Valley, I separated or dislocated some ribs, and I didn't realize it until I was at the gas station on the way home. Like, I came down hard. I was like, oh, man, I pinched my back. You know, felt like I just, you know, stressed it, and it just hurt. And when I walked into the gas station, I stretched my back, and I pushed on my chest, and I felt it sink back in. A little pop, and it took my breath away. And it's, so I've been being real careful with my left arm, trying not to flex anything, and but yeah, it's funny because it was hardly even a crash. I wheelied off something, bike got a little sideways, I let the bike go, and I just fell over. And yeah, I did it. So I wasn't doing anything super crazy.
You know, I rarely, though, think about crashing when I ride. I really try not to, you know, think that way. I really try not to.
Well, it's kind of like if you look at the rock you don't want to hit, you're going to go right at it.
It's the way I see it, so... yeah, I don't, it's not what I think about when I ride. Try not to.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not a good place to be.
Yeah. But I mean, honestly, I've seen some guys that I've ridden with, people who are really fearful as they ride, and it certainly translates into their riding, and you can tell, and almost they're the ones that get hurt the most. You know what I mean? They're so afraid of getting hurt and then they get hurt.
Yeah. It's like the hesitation just brings more problems out of the woodwork.
What you focus on grows, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely a hard mentality to stay in, is that I'm just riding and ignoring all the hazards around me. I'm just having a good time. And you can start to focus on everything around you that can get you hurt, and it's just, yeah, it ruins your day.
Yeah. But, I mean, I don't, like I said, I don't spend a ton of time thinking it happens. I think we all have some bumps and bruises. I've been pretty fortunate till, like I say, this last year I had a couple, but it is what it is. I don't want to get beat up, but it's kind of, you know, part of it.
Mm-hmm.
For sure.
Well, let's look at the brighter side of things. What's been, like, your favorite place to ride?
My favorite places to ride are Wyoming and Moab.
Why Wyoming? Are we talking the big alpine stuff?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I do. If you look on some of my videos, you'll see some of that stuff. I love that country. I love the remoteness of it. I love the grandeur of it. I love the, it's a lot less traveled, probably. You know, some of these loops are big, 70, 80 mile loops, and it's just out there. You know,
single track stuff?
Yeah, single track stuff for sure.
Oh, man, I'd love to go see some of that.
Come with me this year. I'll take you.
All right. All right. I'm actually going to the Wind Rivers in the end of June.
Nice.
So
Du Bois area?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Because my father-in-law plans it. We either go in on the Indian Reservation or we go up to Green River Lakes and we canoe way up into the second lake and then go hiking from there. God, it's unbelievable.
It is.
Even just looking at it on Google Earth, it blows my mind. So... I didn't say any of that. That place sucks. Don't go there.
Yeah, sucks.
Utah sucks too. Don't come here.
And Moab's unique. We've talked just briefly about this before we started, but I love Moab. I love the thing with Moab is there's so many difficult lines that people rarely hit. You know, you can go do Pritchett Canyon we talked about. And there's so many things that people go around because that's where the majority of the line, that's what you generally see. But there's all these lines that you can take otherwise. And so going to Moab's not always the same because you can progress or whatever, and there's bigger drops, there's just always more and bigger and different lines.
Yeah.
And it's also a really cool way to, for me, has been to gauge progress. There's a ride that we do all the time where we go up Pritchett and to the behind the rocks and back, and turn around and then come back down it. And there's this obstacle at the end that we always hit called High Dive, you know what I mean? And just, we've been hitting it for years, but to different lines. And it's just this gauge to go and hit it again another year and see how you do, you know what I mean? And just see how your own progression is changing, you know what I mean? And that's what's so fun about Moab is, for me, it's like, well, it's the same trail, right? And it's like, no, it's not. It's, it can be a totally different experience depending on how you're going to ride it.
Yeah, I totally agree. And we were talking about this earlier too, is that who knows what's going to happen in the future, but as far as things getting shut down and trail access being lessened each year by certain organizations. But I'm excited to see that there are more and more people and groups getting together that are working towards preserving our trails.
Sure.
Like the TPA. I think that one's gaining a lot of traction. And I don't know how the other organizations get funded, but honestly, it's got to come from each one of us to try to maintain those trails. So, yeah, I don't know where the future lies with Moab. Like you were saying, that it might not be around forever the way we know it. But I'm going to do everything I can to try to maintain what's here now for as long as possible.
Right, and I agree. I think enjoy it while you can enjoy it. I'm not saying that, like, but I there's a lot of resistance. So enjoy it while we can. And I contribute to the Blue Ribbon Coalition and those, because I totally agree with you. Say we need to fight to keep it open and support that, and let them know and vote when you can. All the stuff we know, but it's certainly, there is opposition to our sport, and it's not just our sport. As soon as they close it, they'll want the mountain bikers gone next. You know what I mean? Yeah. And then they want it all gone. There is no appeasing those groups. And I don't tend to think that, you know, you can't play with them. You can't appease them. You can't, there is no negotiating with them.
No, unfortunately.
There's not.
I don't think there's no happy medium. That doesn't exist. So
Moab's a cool place. Love Moab.
Yeah.
I meet people that I dirt bike with occasionally, and they're like, you know, I've never been to Moab. I'm like, how could you not go to Moab and you live in Utah?
Yeah, that blows my mind when I hear about that, because it's such a worldwide known destination that you just got to go try it.
And it's great food when you're done riding, you know?
No kidding. Okay, so one of the places we discovered, I think it was just last year. Oh, I'm not wearing it. I had my shirt on the other day, but the Broken Oar. You ever eaten
No.
Where's that? Oh, man.
Tell us.
So as you're driving into town, as it makes that big bend, there's a, I think it's a Maverick or a Sinclair on the right-hand side across the street from like a Hyatt or something. As you go around that bend, there's a road that takes off to the right. It goes about a block back. There's this huge building. Looks like a fancy barn. That's the Broken Oar.
What's their food?
Everything. American cuisine.
Wow. Just
fish, burgers, and anything you want, tacos, spaghetti.
Okay, I'm going to go.
It's so good, but you got to ask for their sweet potato fries.
Okay.
They are unreal. I'm talking sweet potato fries sprinkled with caramel, cinnamon, lemon zest. Oh, man, it's...
We should go right now.
I think so. I'm going in 2 weeks. I can't wait. Oh, it's going to be so good. But yeah, go check out the Broken Oar.
Okay.
Next time you're down there. It's such good food.
You know what's, I've gone to Moab a lot of years now, and then you tell me about, you know, and this, a lot of places to eat down there. It's just, it's such a cool place.
Well, for a while, everybody was like, oh, it's the Blue Pig. You got to go to the Blue Pig. I'm like, well, I don't want to wait 50 minutes to an hour and a half to go sit down and eat. It's too popular, but this Broken Oar, man, I love it. It's my new spot, so.
All right. Well, that's something to look forward to.
Yeah.
So what are you going to ride when you go to Moab? Tell me about your trip.
Oh, man. Well, so what it is we go down there with these contractors, big group of them get together, all in kind of those blue-collar industries, and plumbing and cabinetry, general contractors. They get their side-by-sides and their four-wheelers, and they all go ride down there. I'm the one lone biker generally, or maybe two or three other guys. So
most are side by side guys.
Oh yeah, yeah, all, yeah. It's like 90% side by sides.
Okay.
So I go hang out with them, but we usually ride Poison Spider, Gold Bar Rim, 7 Mile Rim, Metal Masher, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. We like to go do that stuff. I'm pushing them out to the South End this year. Hopefully, we'll see.
Okay.
I don't know because it's been a long time since I've been to the Needles and Behind the Rocks and stuff.
Uh
huh. But yeah, I'm usually kind of hanging out, hitting lines 2, 3, 4, 5
waiting
times.
For them to come.
Yeah, waiting for everybody to catch up. So yeah, we got split up 1 year, and I think I rode Where Eagles Dare 3 times while I was just waiting around.
On Poison Spider there.
Yeah. Yeah, I was waiting for somebody to show up over a ridge, and they never came, so I was just up and down.
Oh, the folly of riding with side by side.
Yeah, I hesitate to invite any of my dirt bikers to come ride. I did 1 year, and
they were impatient.
We all ended up taking off anyway, and then I'd go back and try to find them, and then it rained on us. It was a debacle.
Huh.
So I think I'll just hang out with my dad. I'll probably ride in his side-by-side one of the days and then ride mine. So,
cool.
Yeah. I'm pretty grateful for that relationship I have with my dad. A lot of people can't say that they like to go hang out with their dad all the time, and I have a great relationship with him. We love to go camping. We're buddies.
That is cool.
So,
and you know, that's not just cool. It's a valuable, that's, you know,
yeah,
it's a valuable thing. It's yeah. What life's about.
And as old as he is and all the things that he's taught me, I still learn things from him. So it's been pretty cool.
That is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of what I hope to have with my boys, right? Is
right.
To go take him out sometime riding. Maybe it won't be riding, but hopefully it is. And, you know, take him to these places and yeah, tell him these stories and
mm-hmm.
yeah, just this time with them.
Yeah. Yeah. Have that connection. You can have fun with your dad, you know, just because he makes the rules doesn't mean he can't be fun.
Sure.
So anyway, Sam, thanks for sitting down to talk with me. I really appreciate it, man.
You know, I love talking dirt bikes. I'll talk dirt bikes anytime.
Oh yeah.
So, for sure.
Well, but I'd really want to get hooked up with you. I want to go ride a trail with you and have you teach me a few things.
Well, I don't know if I'd teach you. I can teach you how not to do something.
Or you can, yeah, hit a line and I'll be like, wow, that's cool, one day.
Well, maybe you'll have to come to Pritchett and hit the gap with us sometime.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I need to do that.
You know, going back to Nate, he was like, I'm going to hit it. And I didn't think he would because we've taken some people there. And when they see it, they're like, you know, then they're like, oh, this is different than it looks in the video.
Right.
You know what I mean?
It looks level.
And so when he went for it, it was really cool because it's one of those you commit, right? There's no,
yeah.
You either, yeah.
There's no bailing off the side once you get on the first rock even.
It doesn't, yeah. So he went for it and it was a good time.
Man.
So yeah, come and we'll get you, we'll video you. You can either make the great.
I'll be the first guy to nosedive in.
Actually, this last trip was my first time that I didn't make it across that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Where's the documentation for that?
If you go and look at my one of my very last videos, I did a TBI versus TPI comparison.
Oh.
And I went up it and just didn't get enough launch off the rock and didn't make it. So, and it's, you can
see. Was it a framed rock situation?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, gosh.
But, you know. If you don't break bones or something, then parts are replaceable, right? So that's I didn't make it across it. I got back up and went again and made it, but this was the first time on that I didn't make that.
Dang.
So
one day
we'll do it.
Okay. I want to get connected with you.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you have a story of your own that you'd like to share or like to hear on the podcast, please reach out to me on Facebook, on Instagram, or send an email to thedirtbikejournals@gmail.com. And please like, share, subscribe, write a review about the Dirt Bike Journals so that it will continue to grow. Once again, thank you for listening. See you next time.